Tony.
Hello, Canada. Today's date is March 3rd, 2024. Welcome to a full edition of Canadian Common Sense, Canada's Issues, in about an hour. It is Tony in stormy Saskatchewan.
And Lewis out here in balmy BC.
Yes, you sent me a selfie actually while I was out shoveling snow. And boy, talk about a tale of two opposites. Our friends in Montana sent a snowstorm our way, so much of the prairies is buried in snow. It has already snowed well over 2 feet, and it's still coming down, and it's still supposed to come down tomorrow. So I'm actually just out there shoveling snow round one, round two, round probably seven by the time I'm done.
Yeah. And out here, it's above zero. It's a bright sunshine. It's a beautiful day outside. And hence why I live in the communist state of British Columbia and not in free Alberta or Saskatchewan. So, yeah.
Yeah. And well, I mean, you remember because you used to live in Calgary that I'm hoping that Saskatoon doesn't continue following the Calgary model for residential snow clearing. For those of you who don't live there, that means just wait till a Chinook blows in and melts the snow.
Yeah. And or it could be worse. It could be Edmonton, because I don't know what they do where you are, but it's probably very similar to Edmonton. And they just plow the main roads. They don't plow the residential streets. And so you end up with like a 12 inch drop at the end of your road where you have to drop onto the pavement. I mean, yeah, that was shocking the first winter I spent in Edmonton. But in Calgary, it's like when we lived in Calgary, I had a Mustang GT that I drove year round, and I had it lowered as well. When the Chinook would roll in, it would melt the snow, and then that night it would freeze. And so in the morning, I'd be driving to work, and I would be driving from my house all the way to McLeod Trail, which is the main artery for the south of Calgary to get up to for the southwest of Calgary to get up to downtown. And my car's mufflers were so close to the pavement because the car was lowered that it would just be dragging on the center hump of ice in the road. It would just be all the way to work.
Here in Saskatoon, they do treat it like Edmonton does. They only plow the main thoroughfares and bus routes, and those of us on residential streets, well, good luck to you all. So luckily for me, I've got a full-size pickup, so I've got enough ground clearance and four-wheel drive that I'm okay. But there's just from I was downtown at a workshop, which is why our show is a little later this afternoon, and coming home on what's normally just a leisurely 10-minute drive, I saw so many vehicles stuck trying to get off the side streets onto the main drag or stuck in parking lots. It was insane. I'm glad I'm back home.
Oh, I'm glad I'm in BC.
All right. So, well, actually my workshop, I got to talk about that because that was exciting. Now I don't know how many of our listeners have heard of Wim Hof. Wim Hof, the Iceman. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, for those of you who don't know Wim Hof, when he was 12 years old, he plunged into an icy cold lake just to see what it was like. And he said he felt the cold impact him in a positive way, and he sort of changed his life. And he does a lot of training around the world. He was an extreme athlete. I mean, he's in his 60s now, but he ran the Arctic Marathon barefoot just to prove he could do it. He climbed Mount Everest up to the, I can't remember which station. He climbed it in wearing shorts at any rate.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I went to a workshop for that, and there was a lot of breathing techniques and included an ice bath, which if you haven't ever done an ice bath, you don't even have to go to a Wim Hof seminar. Do an ice bath sometime, folks. Take the plunge. That was fantastic.
Yeah, my son does ice baths on a regular basis. Yeah. Because he works out at the gym, and then he goes and he takes an ice bath afterwards, and it's He just feels totally invigorated afterwards. But Wim Hof is quite the character. I heard him on the Joe Rogan show a few years ago, and he that guy like he leads an expedition up Mount Fuji every year. Or not Mount Fuji, the one in Africa.
Kilimanjaro.
Mount Kilimanjaro. They go up Mount Kilimanjaro every year. He takes a class of people that he has trained in how in his breathing techniques, right? Because the way he withstands the cold is all through breathing techniques. And he teaches these people every year these breathing techniques, and then they do an expedition up Mount Kilimanjaro barefoot in shorts, and most of them shirtless, like, or in tank tops. And I mean, Mount Kilimanjaro has snow on it. Like, he's crazy. I don't know how he does it, but yeah, it's pretty interesting.
He's crazy. That's a really good way to put
Yeah.
it. But yeah, that was really awesome. So anyway, let's get into the show here. We got
Well,
some.
actually, last week I wasn't on the show. I was in Toronto, actually. I was out there with my daughter while she was auditioning for a school, and I got to have dinner in the CN Tower,
Oh, nice.
and yeah, which was pretty awesome. I've done the Space Needle in Seattle before. I've been to the top of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. But this was another level, man. I mean, I believe the restaurant sits at somewhere around 1300 or 1400 feet off the ground. It is unreal. I mean, we were walking around downtown Toronto before that, and there's some pretty big buildings there. And then when you're up in the restaurant and you're looking down on everything, like, it's crazy. It's awesome. And then on the Monday, we flew out Monday night, but we decided to go to Niagara Falls. And so we went down to Niagara Falls on Monday morning. Monday is the time to go to Niagara Falls. There was maybe 50 other people there. It was fantastic. I mean,
Nice.
Niagara Falls in February on a Monday. So there's nobody there, but it was a beautiful day. It was warm, it was a great day. We did Niagara Falls when my daughter was 4 or 5, and my son was just a baby, right? So that was the last time we were there. But I'll tell you, Niagara on the Lake, that is a beautiful little place. That is a pretty neat town. I mean, every house is well over $1 million, but it's a pretty nice little place.
Yeah, actually, when my wife and I went to Hamilton for Grey Cup, we stayed in Niagara on the Lake, and really nice little town and friendly as hell. I really had a good time down there, and
Yeah.
Niagara Falls in November isn't so bad either. It was plus 12 the day we were at the falls, and
Yeah.
I was in shorts and a t-shirt, and people kept look coming up to me, "Aren't you cold?" It's like it was plus 12. Like.
Well, we actually had lunch at the Angel Inn, which is like an English style pub in Niagara on the Lake, and it's just like half a block off of the main drag through town. I highly recommend it. The food was phenomenal, and the people who work there are great, like, best customer service. So yeah, I just had to get it out there. Niagara on the Lake is a great place. Toronto is a little too busy for me. Oakville, we spent some time in Oakville. That loved Oakville. Like, if I had to live in a larger center, Oakville is the kind of town I would pick. It's a really nice place.
That's funny. While you were in there at Oakville, my son was also there visiting his girlfriend because she's going to school in Oakville right now.
Oh
So,
yeah. Right on.
yeah, he took in a Raptors game and they went to see the Ripley's Aquarium and all kinds of good stuff too. So,
Oh, cool.
all right. So now we'll get to some housekeeping, Canada. Last week, I was talking about the PharmaCare program, and I'd said it was going to be a $40 billion tab annually. I was wrong. I misunderstood the parliamentary budget officer. The $40 billion will be the setup for PharmaCare, and the estimated cost would be $13 billion a year. Oh, but that would still save Canadians about $1.5 billion a year on prescriptions that they pay for now. And I said, okay, wait, what? $13 billion a year saves us $1.5 billion. So I'm thinking we're still losing money on this. Maybe my math isn't so good.
No, your math is good. It's the reason is because, and we've talked about this on the show before, 80 plus percent, I think it's actually closer to 90% of Canadians have some kind of drug coverage through work or through the government if you're low income. These things are already covered by private plans. So the drugs that they want to cover, they're taking it off your private insurance now, which you're already paying for. I mean, don't fool yourself. Your premiums are not going to go down because of this. So you're already paying for the coverage on these drugs, but now the government's going to pay for it instead of the plan that you're paying premiums for. So yeah, it's going to be $13 billion a year because, and it's only going to save $1.5 billion because it's already being paid for. So this is, it's the most, it's, I'm starting to get really angry about this stuff. Like, why? Why? This is like the pipeline, like Trans Mountain. It's like the pipeline was going to get built for free because it was going to be a private company that was going to build it. Right. And then, nope, had to put so many roadblocks in their way that the government ended up having to buy it and building it themselves. And it cost $40 billion to do that. Right. And it's like, but it was going to be built for free to the taxpayer. Just like we already have drug coverage in this country through work or through private plans. And it's like, we didn't need this. This was not required.
Yep, absolutely right. And we'll talk a bit more about PharmaCare as far as the bill itself goes when we get into the show topics, but yep, nothing you said is wrong there. So, happened to put this up on our Facebook page. Here is a headline from the Wall Street Journal, and it reads, "It's official. We can pretty much treat COVID like the flu now. Here's a guide." And it just took me back in time, well, almost exactly 4 years when you and I were talking about this virus from Wuhan, which behaves an awful lot like the flu. And we said, yeah, you know what? We should just protect those people who are vulnerable to this new flu-like bug and let everybody else work and get herd immunity so they can pay some taxes for the health care for those that are sick. In fact, I think that's actually exactly what we said.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we've been vindicated again.
Seems to be a regular thing.
Yep, especially on this subject. And that's it's getting to be one of those things I'm tired of talking about, the whole Wuhan thing. But well, we're gonna have to talk about that some more because, well, there's some scientists that we need to discuss in the show. So.
Yeah, yep.
All right. So then on my story I talked about last week at the end of the show, when there was a 12-year-old kid was murdered in Saskatoon by a 12 and 13-year-old. And A, I still can't wrap my head around that, but we had a few listeners write in with some feedback. One listener, Kenny, had written in and said, yeah, that's absolutely horrible. And he, like me, got sick to his stomach just, listening to the story. And he said, like, how do these kids get access to firearms? So I thought, well, I better clear the air on that. I don't believe I said that it was a firearm involved, just that there were weapons charges against the youth. So we don't actually know what kind of weapon was used, because if you assault someone with a knife, for example, that's still assault with a weapon. So,
Same with a baseball bat or a tire iron or bear spray even.
hammer, yeah.
Yeah, all of these things you will get you weapons charges.
Yeah, so we don't know exactly what the weapon was, and we'll never know because they're young offenders, so.
I'm sure that they would have said that it was firearms offenses if it was a firearm was involved. But I mean, nothing's been made public, so we can't really say one way or the other.
Yeah, actually, I think you're right. If a firearm had been involved, Polycet-Souvienne would already have been had released a statement about it.
Well, and Justin Trudeau would have tried to ban a bunch more guns already, too, so.
True. Yeah. Good point. And listener Darren had written in, and just to say that, yeah, you know what? It's this woke culture we live in. Kids don't really believe there are consequences for anything anymore, and. So yeah. Oh, hey, this could be fun. Oh, whoops, he died. Oops.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess that could be part of it. I mean, we've seen things like this happen decades ago, though. I mean, there was the Rena Virk case in Vancouver. That was 25, 30 years ago now. There was the those kids in England, the two boys that abducted that little boy and killed him. And they were only 12 and 13 years old, I believe. So, and that was back in the 90s, I think. So, I mean, this is like, it's not new, but it's also not common. And it's not common in today's world either. So I don't want, people starting to say, oh, this is the new normal, because because it's not. This isn't the new normal. This is a horrible case that happened, but it is isolated. These things don't happen on a regular basis. Like,
Yeah.
in fact, they're extremely rare.
Yeah, and I hope to hell it stays that way. So,
Yeah, me too.
all right, we've got a good show for you today, Canada.
Oh,
Oh.
before we get started, I just wanted to clear one thing up. I'm actually kind of embarrassed by this. I got this wrong on several occasions.
Oops.
When I said that Jagmeet Singh qualified for his pension this year, he did not. He qualifies next year. At the same time, though, in January, I believe it is January or February next year, he qualifies for his pension. So that would explain why he all of a sudden supports the or had this healthcare. This drug plan, the pharmacare plan that he came to an agreement on that doesn't actually have any outline as to what it covers. Because he's desperately just trying to get to that sixth year mark of being elected, right? So
Yeah.
I apologize. I got that wrong, and it's embarrassing because I mentioned it multiple times on this show. So I just wanted to clear the air on that one. Make sure everybody knows that I was wrong.
Hey, no, it's so rare that happens. It's good that you did clear the air. So, all right. So, on the show today, Canada, RIP Brian Mulroney. Pharmacare and elections, online harms and us, provincial budgets hitting the waves, and more. Where do you want to start, sir?
Well, let's start with the obvious one, and that would be Brian Mulroney.
Yeah, it was sad to hear the news on Thursday that Brian Mulroney, Canada's 18th Prime Minister, passed away at the age of 84. And I'm really disgusted by the way the lamestream media was covering the passing of Brian Mulroney. But first, we'll just talk some of the facts about Brian himself. So, Mr. Mulroney became the leader of the Federal Progressive Conservative Party in 1983 after losing to Joe Clark for that same leadership in 1976. He stuck around and then defeated Joe Clark in 1983. And then in September of 1984, he won the what to date has been the largest majority government in Canadian history, 212 out of 282 seats in Parliament. So just short of 75% of the total seats, 50.2% of the popular vote, which is completely unheard of since.
That's, I believe, the only time in modern history of a government having more than 50% of the vote in Canada, too, I believe.
I believe that, yeah, because I cannot imagine any other government because that was huge, yeah. And I got to admit, as nerdy as I was I guess I would have been just about turning 13 when Brian Mulroney won that majority in 1984. I remember dancing in my living room that Trudeau Senior was out of the way, and this new, young looking guy, Brian Mulroney, was taking charge. And well, I was excited for a few years anyway. He started off and he actually got right to work and started pushing through his agenda. And yeah, I mean, he actually wanted to change Canada's constitution, and he took two cracks at it. I mean, the Meech Lake Accord, which started in, I think it was 87, and then Charlottetown in 1992, and both attempts failed. But Charlottetown, for example, actually had borrowed some ideas from the Reform Party, like an equal Senate, an elected Senate. And Joe Clark was actually his intergovernmental affairs minister, or constitutional affairs minister, trying to push Meech Lake through. And it's had, if not for Newfoundland and Manitoba, I believe, were the two dissenting provinces, we could have had an equal Senate today.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, exactly.
now you had mentioned how the mainstream, or I hate to call them mainstream now, but the corporate media decided to cover his death. And it was an article that I sent to you by I believe it was the Canadian Press. And it heavily focused on his scandals. It referred to the ins like the when he met his wife as he they ref in the article referred to her as the bikini clad young woman who was 18 years his junior, I believe,
12.
or 12 years his junior, but like used the words bikini clad, like really heavily focused on his scandals and how Canadians hated him and all this kind of stuff. It was really kind of a disgusting article. I will never defend Brian Mulroney's second term. He did some things that, I really did not agree with, one of which being the GST. That is a tax that we are still trying to get rid of today. It was never supposed to be around long term, but when is a tax ever not permanent? It was supposed to be put in place until the deficit was eliminated. That hasn't happened. And then it was supposed to go away. But yeah, it obviously, just like every other tax in this country, became part of general revenue and just was about making as much money as possible. But yeah, it was a pretty disgusting article as far as I'm concerned. Especially when, the man is dead. Like, I mean, I was no fan of Trudeau Senior, of Pierre Trudeau. I did not like the way he, when he died, it was he was treated like a saint. But I would not never have supported the media just trashing the hell out of him the way they did with Brian Mulroney. And the thing that I don't get. There are news agencies right now, CBC, CTV, some others, that are all praising Brian Mulroney, as if he was like one of the greatest prime ministers of all time, right? And when he was in power, they were doing the exact opposite. And but the but I but you know what the reason that they're all praising him is because is he came out against Pierre Poilievre's idea of conservatism, and so they're all treating him the way the liberal media in the US are treating John McCain. John McCain, when he ran for president, was called a racist by the media. And then when he came out against Donald Trump, the media suddenly started treating him like a hero, right? I mean, and that's what they're doing, or that's what they did with Brian Mulroney. So yeah, it's crazy that even after death, these people, the media, will decide that the person was either a saint or a sinner, and then run with it.
Yeah, I wasn't very impressed with their well, I'm sure he got some praise because he actually gave Justin Trudeau some props just shortly before he died, but I don't think it was really, well, nice, for lack of a better word, to point out, like you say, oh, there was the Airbus scandal, there was the envelopes of cash from Karl-Heinz Schreiber, and the when he sued the government in 2010, I think it was. And of course, yeah, then talk about his scandals and talk about the GST and say, oh, and the fight for free trade. And it's like, well, free trade actually ended up being a good thing. I mean,
It was, yeah.
at the time, yeah, there was a lot of, media against it and a lot of, sentiment against it. But, well, history proved him right. Free trade actually was a big benefit. I remember a friend of mine who lived in Mississauga had said, yep, after free trade, he said buildings started going up left, right, and center here for different businesses and warehousing and whatnot. So that worked out in our favor.
It absolutely did, yeah.
But yeah, I got to admit, Brian Mulroney's second term, I believe it was even later in his first term, I think was when he gave away that CF-18 maintenance contract to Canadair in Montreal when Bristol Aerospace in Winnipeg had a far better bid. But he had to get his Quebec votes happy. And I think that was kind of where it started for me. And that's actually what got the Reform Party going, is they realized that, oh, one more shot against Western Canada. I mean, he did at least get rid of the National Energy Program. But yeah, I think it was probably that Canadair or CF-18 contract, sorry, that really got the Reform Party started. And
Yeah.
ended up really leading to Brian Mulroney's demise. Like I was still behind him in the 1988 election, the quote unquote free trade election. And it was actually good debates that he had with John Turner. You, sir, had an option. And like it was, they were actually two statesmen who fought it out and didn't take shots at each other. They just went after each other's policy. And we just don't see that kind of class anymore.
No. No, we don't. And we also don't see the kind of camaraderie or friendship that that leaders of different countries can have together either. I mean, Mulroney and oh geez, his name just escaped me.
Reagan.
Reagan. Mulroney and Reagan were like really close friends. And it helped with, you know, the free trade agreement. It helped with bilateral relations between the two countries. You know, there was a lot of cooperation between the two countries because of that. And you don't get that anymore. And you don't get that anymore because, you know, you can't be seen to like that guy, you know, like you can't like that guy. He's the devil, right? Like and it's sad. It's sad to see the state of politics today compared to back then. I'm not saying politics were clean back then because they certainly weren't. But at least there was more respect, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Mulroney was also good friends with Margaret Thatcher. And there was one story I was reading that talked about South Africa, because if any of you who are old enough to remember that, Canada was one of the very first countries to speak out against the apartheid regime and to start taking action in the way of sanctions and whatnot against South Africa. And Margaret Thatcher was actually not initially on board. And she thought that Brian Mulroney was being a little too harsh and going too far. And the quote I'd read on in this one article is that as she said to him, well, history will show where you were on this issue. And he just said, indeed it will. And well, he won. So
Yeah, he certainly did. Yep.
So yeah, it's sad to see. I mean, I like you, I'm his second term makes me say, well, I don't miss him in politics, but I don't think we'll see his kind again as far as just the gentleman politician.
Yeah, the statesman.
The statesman, yeah. So rest in peace, Mr. Mulroney. I'm sure there's going to be a state funeral because I think that's standard for heads of government. So, well, if Ed Broadbent got one, so I guess Brian Mulroney had better get one because Broadbent shouldn't have.
That's true. That's true, yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the government we've got now. So PharmaCare is now, well, the bill has passed first reading in the House. And you and I talked about that because I dug in a little bit on it as far as some of the implementation goes in the summary and realized that it's just going to be that big elephant in the room. I think that is why Jagmeet Singh came out so quickly and said, oh, yep, contraceptives and insulin will be covered. But nowhere in the bill does it talk about that. So I'm guessing that's just something that they promised him and it will end up never coming to fruition. Just like, so go ahead, Lewis.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's nothing in the bill that says what is going to get covered. It says that they're going to put a committee together to decide which drugs will be covered.
And here's the best part of that committee. So I read through the summary of the bill, and the PharmaCare bill is actually only 6 pages long. So that was an easy one to get through. So within 1 year to the day that the bill received royal assent, so within 1 year of the bill becoming law, the Canadian Drug Agency must provide a list of essential prescription drugs and related products to work toward a national formula to establish the scope of what Canadians will be able to access. So basically, that Canadian Drug Agency needs to decide which drugs are going to have the government cover. All right. So,
Oh, so basically, this is never going to happen
right. And
because this government has never met a deadline. So, I mean, there is no way that this group of ineptitudes could possibly put together a committee to discuss these drugs and decide on a list of drugs in a year. No way. Sorry, can't happen. Won't happen. These guys are completely incompetent, and there's no way that they'll meet a deadline. They still haven't come up with a buyback program for firearms. They've had to extend the deadline twice. Like they can't even meet their own self-imposed deadlines.
yep, exactly. And if you want more proof that they're not going to meet this deadline, it says, well, once this list is prepared, the health minister will consult with stakeholders, which is the provinces, indigenous groups, etc., on implementation and on a bulk buying strategy. This also has to take place within 1 year to the day after the bill is given royal assent. So what if the Canada Drug Agency said takes 364 days to develop that list? You're gonna get all the provinces together in 1 day and decide how to make that list happen and decide on a bulk buying strategy?
Wow, this is, yeah, never gonna happen. I mean, they know they're not winning the next election, so this program is just gonna get canceled anyway, so that's probably what they're counting on.
Well, I'm sure it is because, yeah, I mean, if it even receives royal assent before the next parliament falls, which will be on the budget, we're going to talk about that right away. It just wouldn't, it wouldn't happen because, well, you're right. They won't be in government. And whoever the next government is, which will be Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives, they're sure as hell not going to keep this thing around. They're deliberately being vague just so they can win over some votes. And then when the time comes to implement it, oops, well, we weren't able to make that happen for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have a history of creating programs that nobody uses
Yeah.
just to make it look like they're doing something.
Well, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. And so immediately, Alberta and Quebec both said, hard pass. Quebec, I can understand why not, because they've already got a drug plan as part of their healthcare plan provincially. So Quebec said, nope, just give us the money and we'll administer as we feel fit. Alberta said basically the same thing, said, nope, just give us the money and we'll develop our own plan. Saskatchewan has now decided to sit on the fence and say, well, maybe we shouldn't opt in either. So this hasn't even gone through the House. You've now got three provinces representing 25% of the national population saying, no, no thanks. So, yeah, this thing's dead in the water.
Yeah, and I mean, guaranteed, the province of BC is fully on board because we're fully on board with everything that's socialist.
Canada, if you could see Lewis's face right now. I mean, yes, the Socialist Republic of BC is definitely beautiful, but it is the Socialist Republic of BC. All right. So now we talked about elections. Danielle Smith, full disclosure, I love her. Danielle Smith said, yeah, you know what? It's time for an election. The Trudeau just needs to call an election. He's running around electioneering anyway. So just call an election already. And I said, you know what, Miss Smith? I'm with you. Call an election already. We need a damn election. Justin Trudeau is running around the country making housing announcements. And when he decided to make the housing announcement in Alberta, he didn't even tell Danielle Smith he was coming to Alberta. He just showed up with Mayor Amarjeet Soji. And I can't remember, I think old Randy Wassenaar was there.
Of
And
course he was. What a
yeah.
douche.
Yeah. Tell us how you really feel about Mr. Wassenaar. And so yeah, Danielle Smith said, okay, well, if he really wants to diss the Premier of Alberta that way, fine. Get rid of Stephen Guilbeault and you're out electioneering anyway. Call a goddamn election. Yeah, call it, Justin. Call the election. Please.
Yeah, I'm still bullish on there being an election in May. I still think it's going to happen.
I agree.
I just wish that it would happen sooner rather than later. I mean, that what he did in Alberta was downright underhanded and slimy as hell. I mean, showing up without telling the government that he's coming to make this announcement, just flying in under the radar, getting in there, making this announcement. The media asks, "Hey, where's the provincial representative?" And he goes, I'm paraphrasing. I don't know. I wish they would be part of it, but they're not. And the provincial government goes, "We didn't even know this was happening." Like, it's just so underhanded. It's like he's out to get Danielle Smith.
Well, he's using
Like,
her as the boogeyman for that election call. It's going to be yet another election where he beats up on Alberta as the bad boy, and Pierre Poilievre is from Alberta, and he's going to bring that to Ottawa.
well, I got news for him. A lot of people in this province really wish that Danielle Smith was, or sorry, a lot of people in this country really wish that Danielle Smith was their premier.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear it all the time.
I hear it all the time in Alberta, or sorry, BC. Freudian slip. I hear a lot of people here in BC who say the same thing. They wish that Danielle Smith was our premier. And I do too.
Yep, I'd love to have her here. And I hear people in Ontario say that. I hear people in the East say that. That's, yeah, she's a lot more popular than Justin Trudeau thinks she is.
Oh yeah, no, he's kind of delusional. He thinks that he can use a really popular premier as the boogeyman, right? He thinks he can use really popular legislation in Alberta as like an example of what we can expect from Pierre Poilievre federally. And it's like, yeah, I think that's why he's leading in the polls, you dummy.
Yeah. Well, that and because Justin Trudeau comes up with these brilliant ideas like okay, you sent this to me, the gender inclusive demining of Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah, I still haven't figured that one out, and I've read it four times.
So what I can gather from it is it the people who will be hired to get rid of landmines in Ukraine are now going to be gender diverse, as in you apparently must have, I'm gonna assume, because I don't actually know, assume that there's going to have to be an equal number of females out there finding landmines as males. So maybe Justin Trudeau hates women because he wants them to get blown up just as much as he wants men to get blown up, finding landmines.
Yeah, I'm confused by this one. I mean, don't forget that under in Justin Trudeau's world, there is not two genders. There's 67 or 87 genders, right? So is there going to have to be a representative from every gender?
Well,
I just don't get this. Like, why is that important? When you're talking about mind sweeping and that, like, you don't you kind of want people who've done it before, people who know what they're doing, to get rid of these minds so you don't miss any? I mean, isn't that important? Or is it really more important that, hey, we've got this, we got our we got women clearing minds. Woo! Or, we've got black women clearing mines. Woo! I think it's more important that we're just clearing mines.
See, I'm on board with you on that one. I think maybe you have a whole team of women if they happen to be the best minesweepers in the country.
Yeah.
Fantastic, do it. But do you have to make that? I guess, well, he's giving $4 million for that program, so I guess that funding probably would be contingent on making it gender diverse. And I just
It's
want the
like,
best damn Ukrainian minesweepers possible,
yeah,
period.
like I said, like I've said this on many other issues. If the best minesweeper in Ukraine is a woman, or if the 10 best minesweepers in Ukraine are women, or if the 100 best minesweepers in Ukraine are women, make them all. They make all the minesweepers women. I don't care. But let's not pretend that, lowering standards to make things equal is actually a good thing, because it's not.
No, that's right. We've seen evidence of that. Well, in our own country, there's in back in BC in the late 90s, I believe it was, when the provincial fire service decided they were going to lower the physical exam requirements, or the standards, I should say, in order to encourage more women to get into the fire department, for provincial fire department. And that didn't work out so well. I don't know how long it took before they dropped it, but I know it didn't take long.
No, it's you can't do that. Like, I'm sorry, but it's like having someone in there who is not qualified or not physically able to do the job, just because they're a member of a group that needs that the government believes needs to be lifted, is not a good thing. It's just like when they have quotas for university, and you have to have a student body that represents the general public. So if you have, 13% of the population is black in the United States, it means 13% of your student body has to be black. Well, they have found that that actually has worse outcomes than just admitting the people who deserve to be there with the right grades. Because they get there and they find that they can't do the work because they don't have the intellectual ability to do the work because they didn't get the grades in high school to show that they deserve to be there. And so you get a lot of dropouts. You get more dropouts by doing that than if you just admit the people who qualified.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, well, speaking of dropouts, as Justin Trudeau is running around the country making housing announcements, well, there's actually another underlying reason why he's making all these announcements that the government is going to partner up with municipalities to build houses. And then actually listener Ashley sent this over last night, and literally 10 minutes after she had sent that message and I'd replied to her, you had sent an article talking about that exact same thing, that the government is quietly getting out of the first-time homebuyer incentive program.
Yeah, and it's about damn time. When they brought it out, I believe it was about 5 years ago, when they brought the program in the first place, we talked about it on the show and how we were opposed to it. Because what happens is the government will contribute up to 10% of the purchase price if you qualify. But they are on the title. The government of Canada will be on the title of your house. So this is not like a loan. It is part ownership. Now, it is a loan in that it has to be paid back, and it has to be paid back in one of two circumstances. If you sell the house, you have to pay back that loan. If you pay off your mortgage after 25 years, you then have to pay off that loan back to the government. Now, that loan is not like the payback on that loan is not the 10% of the purchase price that you borrowed. It is 10% of the value. So if you pay off your mortgage and then your house is valued, say you bought the house for $500,000. 25 years later, that house is going to be worth $2 million, $2.5 million. Okay. It is no longer $50,000 you got to pay back. It is now $250,000 or $300,000 that you have to pay back. It is 10% of the value or 10% of the sale price when you sell it. So if you buy it for 500, turn around, 10 years later, and you sell it for $1 million, you now owe the government $100,000, not $50,000. So it was not a program that a lot of people, even though they qualified, even used. And there was, in that article I sent you, there was a mortgage broker who was in that article talking about how in the 5 years that they've been doing mortgages with this program in place, only two of his clients even qualified because the qualification to use the program was so, like, it made for a very narrow window that you had to fit in. And another mortgage broker or a representative of a mortgage company, I believe, was in that article as well, and said that a lot of people would just, when they found out that the government was going to be on title, they walked away from it. They didn't want anything to do with it was sharing the equity of the house with the government. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who did qualify didn't even use it because they didn't want the government on title. So it was a flawed program in the first place. And I believe at the time I even said, just like we've said for a lot of programs that the government has put in place in the last few years, it was a program to show that they were doing something when they actually weren't.
Yeah, that's actually the best way to put it, because that describes so many programs from this government.
Yeah.
So, as we both just said, we're still bullish on a May election. But just so we have the other side, I did a little bit of digging for you, Canada. In 2019, the election saw 91 rookie MPs elected in 2019. Now, there was a small handful of those 91 who were not re-elected in 2021, but we have fully one quarter of the House of Commons who will not qualify for a pension until October of 2025. So there's not going to be a big appetite for an election among, well, 20 Bloc Québécois MPs, for example, of I believe it's 31 that they have. So
Yep.
a large, you know, more than half the Bloc Québécois caucus is probably not that eager for an election. And in 2019, there were 38 conservatives who were rookies, 24 liberals, the, well, 21, now 20 Bloc members, seven NDP, including Jag. Well, I guess Jagmeet Singh was earlier, and he was in a by-election.
He
So
was.
yeah, so it was earlier in 2025, but, and then one Green Party MP as well. So there may not be as much appetite among the MPs, but I don't think that's going to matter because Justin Trudeau could not care less if Jagmeet Singh doesn't collect a pension by the, you know, as an example.
No, and this again reinforces my opinion that MPs shouldn't even get a pension. Pensions, the Liberals qualify for the same CPP that everybody else gets. I don't think that, you know, because this is what happens. People start looking at their own personal bank accounts and their own personal future as the driving force between which way they vote, which is wrong. It isn't why you're there. You're there to represent your community in Ottawa. But it has become, you know, like I've said many times on this show, it has now become the MP is now Ottawa's representative in your riding, not your riding's representative in Ottawa, which is what it should be. And it's become a job, it's become a career, and not a honor, like a duty. And that's what it should be. It should be a temporary duty that you do because, you know, your community wants you to, and they pick you to be their representative. Whereas it has become a career for people, and conservatives are not immune to that. Many of the members of the caucus in of the conservative caucus have been there for a couple decades. Pierre
Pierre
Poilievre,
Poilievre.
yeah, Pierre Poilievre being one of them. I mean, and this is why, like, and I will say it again, I am sick to death of hearing people complain and make fun of Justin Trudeau for having been a substitute teacher before he became an MP. I am sick to death of hearing conservatives say this stuff about him, because Pierre Poilievre has an even smaller resume than him, because his only job has ever been an MP. And before he was an MP, he was a teenager working for MPs.
Yep.
Like, he has been involved in government since he was a teenager. He has never had a job outside of government. So stop making fun of someone who actually might have had a job. I mean, he might not have been very good at it. He might have gotten fired from it, but at least he had one. And so we can't be, you know, hypocritical, you know, because it makes us look like fools.
Yeah, good point. So to wrap this segment up, here's how I think it's going to go down is we're going to see a federal budget later this month. I'm sure of it. I mean, early April, the very latest. What I see happening is that a lot of Liberal MPs are told to stay home when it comes time to vote for said budget. And Justin Trudeau engineers the demise of his own government and has a huge spending budget. Remember, I'd mentioned last week that Chrystia Freeland freed up another $57 billion to spend. And they're going to campaign on that budget, just like Doug Ford did, because they saw how well it worked for Doug Ford. That's my prediction.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right.
So we'll, I hope it does actually meet out that way, just because two-thirds of Canadians polled want an election right now because they're sick of Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, that's a number we haven't seen in a long, long time, because I don't even think, as hated as Harper was by lefties in this country, I don't even think it was that high for him.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
So, well, let's see if we even get to talk about that election pretty soon, because now we've got online harms legislation being brought into the House. Now, we had talked back about censorship when C-11 came along, and I thought yeah, we're going to be okay with C11. C18 came along, which was another censorship bill. That was the internet censorship bill. And well, we managed to stay under the radar on that one. Bill C63, the Online Harms Act, I don't think anybody is safe from this one.
Nope. This will actually pretty much eliminate a lot of podcasts, including ours, including the Joe Rogan podcast, which, truth be told, is the one that everybody will be upset about because it's the number one podcast in the world. It's first among men and second among women, believe it or not. So it's because the way the legislation is written, a lot of what we say on this show could be considered fomenting hatred. And not because we actually are fomenting hatred, but because the Human Rights Tribunal could see it that way. If you speak negatively about someone or a group, if you like, when we talk about how we don't believe that trans women are women, and that they shouldn't be competing against other natural born women in sports, that under this legislation could be considered hate speech. And if this bill passes, I am very, very sorry to say we will be closing this podcast down.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no real way we could continue doing what we do with the freedom with which we do it under this legislation. Like Pierre Poilievre actually said it right, that this hate speech is going to be speech that Justin Trudeau hates. That will be the new definition of hate speech.
Well, because I mean, all you have to do is just look at some of the rulings from the Human Rights Tribunal in this country or the various provincial human rights tribunals across this country and realize that it does not take much to get taken to the Human Rights Tribunal, and it does not take much for them to rule in favor of the complainant. And this legislation also includes, up to life sentences for online hate crimes. It also, which, by the way, if you, I almost, this has me so angry because there are so many worse crimes out there that do not get that kind of punishment. Child molestation. What do you get? 18 months, maybe? Murder. I just saw a guy get sentenced for manslaughter for 8 years. That's what he got. That was here in Canada. 8 years. You see, violent assaults get 18 months, 6 months, house arrest, gun smuggling, something that Harper had a minimum sentence, I believe, of 5 years, or maybe it was even higher, but there was a minimum sentence. I've seen gun smugglers sentencing getting an ankle bracelet and house arrest. There's been like unbelievably low punishment for actual serious crimes, and now they're talking about a lifetime, like life sentences for hurting someone's feelings or fomenting hate, whatever that means. I mean, I'm sure that, someone who says, oh, trans women aren't women, isn't going to get a life sentence, but it's unbelievable that like you can take someone's life in this country and not get a life sentence, but if you commit a hate crime, you can. And not to mention that there's like some minority report BS in this bill as well, that like you can be arrested before you commit a hate crime.
Yeah, now this is something we had talked about when this bill was first brought up, I think last year. And you're exactly right. You can, if anonymous citizen X thinks that you're going to say something hateful or something that will hurt their feelings, they can get a peace bond taken out against you. And the police can come, give you the ankle bracelet, take away any firearms you might own if you happen to own firearms, because now you're considered dangerous. And somehow you have to, I guess, prove that you're indeed not going to say something hateful, I guess.
Yeah, this is pretty scary stuff. Like this is really, really scary stuff.
Yeah, and what's worse about this is not only can anonymous citizen X make a random complaint against podcaster Y that they don't like, they don't have to identify themselves. So podcaster Y has no right to face their accuser, but can face up to $20,000 in fines from the HRC. And on top of that $20,000, have to pay an up to $50,000 penalty to the government for wasting their time, I guess.
Yeah, and that $20,000 fine goes to the complainant.
Yes.
So there's an incentive for people to complain about online hate crimes, whether they're a hate crime or not. There's a financial incentive to do it. And it's a $20,000 incentive. And then if you get, like you said, there is another fine on top of that that can be as high as $50,000, and you have to pay that to the government because somehow they're the victim. But no, this is super scary. It's wrong on so many levels. The fact that you won't even know who your accuser is unbelievable. Like I can't even find the word to describe how I actually feel about that. Because you should have a right to face your accuser. How can you defend yourself if you don't even know who the accuser is? You can't even have a proper defense if you don't know who the accuser is.
Well, exactly. So then you're going to see now outfits like Press Progress, for example, definitely not a right-wing publication by any means, or the Narwhal out there accusing anybody they disagree with of fomenting hatred. And well, all they got to do is get a human rights tribunal to agree with them. How hard is that in this country?
It's not hard at all. I
Yeah.
mean, look at the stand-up comedian in Quebec who got taken to the Human Rights Tribunal because he made a joke about a sick kid, and he lost, and it pretty much ruined his career. It financially destroyed him, and then there was a stand-up comedian in BC here who got sued under the by someone who took them to the Human Rights Tribunal, and he lost that as well. And I believe that one was a $30,000 fine, because a woman in the crowd was ridiculing him during a show, ruining the show for everybody in the club. And I believe, and excuse my language, but I believe he called her a dyke. And that warranted a $30,000 fine.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not like this is theoretical that this stuff could happen. It's fact. It's happening. It already is happening. And it's been happening for many, many years.
Yeah.
And it's so we're not like conspiracy theorists here. Like this is actual stuff that's already happening.
Yeah,
And
now it's just an.
they just want to expand it.
Yeah, so now it'll be codified into law. And you're going to hear Canada, you already are hearing, this is about protecting kids. It's all about protecting kids. Well, part of the legislation actually is about protecting kids, and I don't have any problem with that. What I have a problem with is that they've expanded it and made it an omnibus bill to include censorship. And when the conservatives speak out against censorship, they don't want to protect kids. Well, no, I have no problem protecting kids. And here's where the kids part comes in. They have just said they content that sexually victimizes a child or re-victimizes somebody, revenge porn, which is intimate content shared without consent of the, person who's in it, content used to bully a child, content that induces a child to harm themselves, content that foments hatred, you mentioned, content that incites violence or extremism or terrorism. I have no problem with any of that stuff. But if it's suddenly now a hate crime or hate speech just to say, yeah, I believe a man is a man, a woman is a woman, and a biological man shouldn't be in a female MMA ring, for example. That is now hate speech, and you will be brought in front of a human rights tribunal and fined $20,000. Go to hell, all of you.
No, it's insane. And I mean, I don't even agree with adding those other ones that you mentioned, fomenting hatred,
It's inciting violence.
inciting violence and a terrorist activity, because it's already in law. Like, why is this part of a basically a human rights tribunal bill? Because that's basically what this has become. Those things are already in law. It's already illegal to incite violence. It's already illegal to promote, terrorist activity and all of that. That's already in the criminal code.
Yeah, exactly. And now this is aimed almost exclusively at social media sites, internet users communicating with other users. And exempt it is sorry, not the social media companies as well. It's not applied to social media companies, so the Facebooks and Instagrams and Twitters of the world. It's not applied to broadcast entities. So CBC can say all the hate they want and they're exempt. And they do. They foment a lot of hate.
Oh, they sure do.
Yep. And then telecommunications companies are also exempt from it, and as are private messaging apps. So if you have Google Messenger or Google Meet, for example,
Or WhatsApp or
WhatsApp, Signal, yeah, that kind of stuff. And side note, I have to say Signal very carefully because I'm in a couple chat groups on Signal, and I once said that to my wife. She's like, "Why are you in a singles chat group?" I'm like, no, Signal. So, yeah, so private messaging apps, okay. Social media sites, definitely bad. Television, any kind of broadcast medium, no problem. So, hateful editorials from the Toronto Sun are still going to be out there, but don't you dare say anything on Twitter.
So it's basically general public is not allowed to do these things, but the elites are allowed.
That's kind of how I read it. Yeah. So let's move on from that one. Now, there's three provinces in Canada that are going to have provincial elections this year, that being BC, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick, unless any other government happens to fall. So the budgets are being very reflective of that so far. Now, Nova Scotia just released their budget for the year. They're going to have about a $500 million deficit because they're putting more money into healthcare. Okay, no problem. Do what you got to do. BC decided to win the Hold My Beer Olympics this year and said, yeah, we're going into an election year. Let's have a record budget deficit for this upcoming year. Lewis, do I want to know how much that is?
It's just shy of $8 billion.
Woo! Ooh.
It's like, and that's a record, by the way. That is the largest deficit in BC history, and we're not in the middle of a pandemic, and we're not in the middle of a Great Depression. The economy is not great at the moment, but it's not like in the toilet. I mean, this is I don't know why they think think that this is actually a good thing. I mean, believe it or not, the provincial NDP in BC are still pulling in, I believe it's almost 50% support. Like, it's really high. I believe it's somewhere between 45 and 50% support right now. So I don't understand it. I mean, not especially after the premier told us we weren't allowed to call each other British Columbians anymore, because that might be offensive. I don't know how, but apparently that might be offensive. So we're supposed to say people who live in BC, rather than British Columbians. No, sorry, I'm a British Columbian. So after he said that, after they were trying to give away control over all Crown land in the province to First Nations groups, the record deficits, the trying to get rid of our natural gas furnaces and all of that kind of stuff, they're still pulling in between 45 and 50% support. I don't get it. But one thing that I really don't understand is that they've got all this support, yet they think they have to blow out the budget to get more. Like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, in fact, showing some fiscal restraint right about now might actually get you even more support. But the thing in this province is that the BC United Soccer team, I mean, sorry, political party, their support is like they're in third, like a solid third in the polls. The BC Conservatives are a solid second. Like, there is no danger of the BC United dethroning the BC Conservatives at this point. But the BC United, most conservatives in this province are completely through with BC United. We're done with them. They haven't been even remotely conservative for at least a decade now. And it really started 16 years ago when they brought in the carbon tax, and it has only gotten the party's only moved further left ever since. So the BC Conservatives are actually in a solid second place now. So I actually expect that to get worse for the BC for BC United before the election comes in the fall. I think people are going to see that they don't, that they're not a contender anymore. And so the conservatives are going to make a pretty good showing, I think, in the fall here. I think that they're going to actually be a pretty strong opposition party. Like, they're going to have quite a few seats in the House, I believe. And the NDP are going to come away with another majority, unfortunately. I like I said, I don't understand it. I just wish that, we could carve off from Vancouver and the southern half of Vancouver Island, and that could be their own province, and the rest of BC could either join Alberta or become our own province, because it's we just do not share anything with Vancouver. Like, anything that is good for the rest of this province, everybody in Vancouver is opposed to. And so yeah, I just wish that we could have this province be two separate provinces.
Well, and it might not hurt you to join Alberta because they also have released a budget. And well, what do you know? Rather than a deficit, they're sitting on a looks like a modest $2.6 billion surplus, if I read that correctly. And well, they've said, well, we need to keep some extra cash there just in case, because They've decided they're going to start their forest fire season a little early this year, although there's no election, so I think climate change won't be causing too many more wildfires this year. But I guess you never know.
Well, I mean that's something that Ralph Klein did when we were living in Alberta, was that any surplus went into a fund to save for a rainy day. They called it the Heritage Fund. And after, I would say in Ralph Klein's later years as premier, that started to erode. That wasn't quite what it was being used for anymore. Although they did send Albertans checks a couple of times, because they were pulling in so much of a surplus. And then after Ralph Klein was no longer premier, there was like Ed Stelmach, and then there was
Redford.
Redford, Alison Redford, who wasn't even a conservative. Don't know how she ever won the leadership. But they just blew out the spending, and it just kept going with the NDP, obviously, because that's what they do. And now Danielle Smith has to rein it all back in and start paying this debt off, because under Ralph Klein, Alberta was debt-free, like absolutely debt-free. And now I believe they have what, 50 or 60 billion in debt.
It's something huge. Yeah, it might even be more than that.
So, I mean, you can see where Alberta governments have like just totally lost their way. And so now Danielle Smith's got to rein this all back in and start paying that debt back down again. And she will. I mean, before she's retired, I don't think that they'll get it all paid off. Obviously not. It's just too big of a number. But I hope that, governments and premiers that follow her will take her lead.
Well, that would be nice. And she's given a very small shot to EV drivers. And I think she should have gone a lot deeper up until this new Alberta budget. And I guess it hasn't actually been passed yet. Saskatchewan remains the only province in Canada that actually charges EV drivers for a road use tax. And here it's only 150 bucks a year. And well, I'm sure with the amount of gas that I buy, I'm paying more than 150 bucks for road taxes. So the Alberta budget has said, well, we're going to charge EV drivers 200 bucks a year on the registration of their vehicles, which is how we do it here. And for a road use tax, well, you'd think she took a bomb and set it ablaze underneath someone's Tesla. They're not very happy about 200 bucks. Get over it, folks.
Yeah, like where, how do you think that they're gonna pay for road construction, infrastructure projects, maintenance of highways and bridges and overpasses? I mean, where do you think that money comes from? Like
Exactly.
it comes from gas taxes. So if you're not paying for gas, like you need to pay your share. You use those roads. You use the roads, you use the bridges, you use the overpasses. You need to contribute, or could just put a toll system in on all the highways. I mean, that's the other option, pay to use, right? So, I mean, that's the way this works.
Yeah, it really shouldn't be so hard to comprehend that hey, you gotta pay your way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's this like superiority mentality that a lot of and I'm not saying all EV drivers are like this, but a lot of them are. They feel superior, morally superior, and they should be rewarded for that. And it's like, no, we still got to pay for the road. We still got to pay for the maintenance of the road, fixing potholes and all of that. And if you're going to go driving a 2024 Hummer that weighs 9,000 pounds, by the way. It's an electric vehicle. It weighs 9,000 pounds. That's gonna do some wear and tear to those roads.
Yep.
And you need to help pay for that. You can't, no, sorry. I don't feel sorry for you at all.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're going to wrap it up there, Canada. I've got to go shovel some more snow while Lewis goes to get a suntan. So we do want to thank you for joining us. And until next week, it is Tony in Saskatchewan.
And Lewis out here in BC. Good night.
Good night, Canada.
And Tony.